I'm Steve Kraske, and this is KCUR's Up to Date. Kansas City, Missouri has a violent crime problem. It's so bad, in fact, that community programs, more cops, even a mayor-appointed task force aren't helping. So today we've asked two former members of the Board of Police Commissioners to share their thoughts about what it might take to solve the problem. Then, a close look at our relationship to Mexico with the former border czar for Presidents Clinton and Obama. We'll ask him which issues a border wall would address and which it would ignore. Later, Bill Brownlee brings us this week's Local Listen. We'll get you up to date after this hour's news. We all know about Kansas City's soaring crime problem this year and the vicious run of homicides that this community has experienced. Kansas City's reputation as one of the nation's most violent cities remains very much intact, despite all kinds of efforts to get a handle on it. Today, we've invited two former presidents of the Kansas City Board of Police Commissioners to talk about this crisis and what should be done about it. Jeff Simon is a lawyer at Hush Blackwell. He served as board president in 1999 and 2000. Jeff, welcome back.
Good morning, Steve.
Pat McInerney is also here. He's a lawyer at Spencer Fane. He served as board president from 2010 to 2012. Pat, good morning to you.
Morning, Steve.
I guess, gentlemen, the $10 million question here is, why can't this town get a better handle on violence that always seems to be on the rise? Jeff?
Steve, I think the answer to that, if you look back 20, 30, 40, 50 years, we've been asking the same questions. And we're here in our capacity as former police commissioners. And the first thing people need to understand is this is not just a police problem. There is a little bit that the police can do and a little bit that they can do better. But violence goes way beyond anything the police can solve.
But police, people in the community always look at, to the police as being the place to resolve all this.
It all ends up on the police's doorstep, and they certainly have a role in it. But preventing violence, reducing violence, changing the culture of violence, that's a much more difficult problem that isn't going to change until people stand up and say, we've had enough.
Pat?
You know, Jeff's exactly right, and I think that there are a ton of different causes of this, and if you had 20 people around this table, Steve, you'd have 20 different answers about right. What causes it and different solutions. What we do know is that there are some things that work, and we know that information-based policing and information-based deployment works. We know that community relationships and trust in the community works, and half a dozen other things. It's a matter of managing and combining all those things that we know are effective in certain respects into a comprehensive violence reduction approach.
But, you know, arguably, there's something called KC Nova that is an attempt at just what you're talking about, Pat. It's a comprehensive approach, multi-agencies, helping potential perpetrators of violent crime get a handle on their lives.
Right.
And even that, somehow, it showed some initial signs of success and maybe continuing success, but the numbers don't seem to suggest it's working.
You know, I was on the board when Cincinnati came to Kansas City and said, look, this is what NOVA looks like, and this is how we approached it, and this is what we think is a good model for it. At the time they came, Cincinnati was just beginning to experience an uptick in violent crime in Cincinnati, despite 3 years of experience with NOVA. So there is some cyclical movement around violent crime. We know that violent crime spikes and it declines. It's violent crime nationally is up 7.5% in the last 2 years. Homicides are up 11. But that's never an excuse for wringing your hands and saying, hey, you know what? It's a trend. We can't do anything about it, because there are extraordinary efforts going on in this community right now. And I kind of shudder to think what it would look like if we didn't have those efforts going on, including NOVA, including hotspot policing, and the combination of the two.
And the difficult thing is you can never prove something that doesn't happen, right?
You can't prove a negative. Correct.
Yeah. Jeff Simon, this idea that the community perhaps needs to be more engaged and stand up and say no more. There are already, as you know, a lot of community groups dealing with this. What are you talking about? What else needs to happen?
Steve, I'm talking about the communities that aren't directly affected by it. I'm talking about the communities whose three-year-old children aren't on the playground getting a stray bullet to the head. I'm talking about the business community. I'm talking about the suburban communities. I'm talking about the people who we've gotten to a point where you read stories about children on playgrounds getting shot, and you say, isn't that terrible? And you move on. No, that's a tragedy. And if it's happening a half a mile or three blocks from where we live, or if it's happening 15 miles from where we live, it is all of our problem. It's not just the problem of the families that are suffering the violence in the community directly involved.
So wave the magic wand here, Jeff. What would you like to see happen?
Golly, Steve, how much time do you
have? Right.
But what I would like
about
to 15 see...
15 more minutes.
sorry, Pat.
Yeah, I'll leave.
Here's what I'd like to see happen, Steve, and this may be a little too philosophical, but I'd like to see us all start thinking of one another as human beings again, okay? And the fact that my child is not on the playground at risk of getting hit by a stray bullet is just a product of where I happened to fall in life when I was born, okay? It's my good fortune that that's not my child, but it is, in a sense, my child. They're all ours. So it is getting people to care and understand. And it kind of boils down to this, Steve. An eye-opening moment for me when I was first on the police board. I knew nothing about the east side of Kansas City. And I was doing a ride-along with a very veteran police officer. And he told me, you know, I was seeing things I'd never seen before. And he told me this. He said, you know, 95% of the people who live in the worst part of Kansas City, in this neighborhood or anywhere else, are good people. Good people who want to live their life, work their job, raise their children, worship, maintain their property, and live the life that we all want to live. Yeah. 5% are jerks, not the word he used. Mm-hmm. He said, why can't we leverage the 95% of these good people and put down the 5% of the jerks? And this is a jaded, cynical, 25-plus-year-old street cop saying this.
Well, that reminds me, you know, there is this notion, Pat, and I know you've dealt with it a lot, this anti-snitching culture that pervades certain parts of our community, this notion that people might see something, they might know something about a crime that occurred, but they're hesitant to say anything about it to the police. And there's reasons for that. You know, one is a cultural thing. The other thing is they don't want to get in trouble themselves and maybe put themselves at risk for their getting violence directed at them. How do you crack that?
You know, when we talk about communications, we talk about community relationships, those are exactly what cracks that. Because when you have a chief of police who gets on his motorcycle and goes into the city and talks to people.
Like Daryl Forte, a recent chief, yeah.
When you have majors and you have captains who are engaged in the blocks and the neighborhoods and the specific neighbors that they police at the same time, that's critical. This no-snitch culture is also countered by something you just talked about, and that is the combination of NOVA and hotspot policing. And those are both phenomenons that we've seen here in the city in the last 3, 4, 5 years.
NOVA,
and
the No Violence Alliance is what you're talking about.
Yeah, that's correct. And what it does is it combines hotspot, which is intensive deployment of law enforcement officers into a certain geographic area, with intelligence-based police. It's kind of smart spot policing, right? Mm-hmm. And that needs to be, in my estimation, from a tactical standpoint, that has to be encouraged. That has to grow. It's already growing, but like Jeff was talking about, where the concern is focused, the money flows, the resources flow. And if we can get people who live in Jeff's neighborhood and in my neighborhood engaged and viewing victims as their brother and their sister, then the resources follow.
In general, as you guys oversaw the department, was it your sense that the police, just in general, were officers and commanders getting out often enough into the community to sort of talk and just visit and not just be all about arresting people and putting them in paddy wagons?
Yeah, Steve, and I was on the board. I started in 1996, and it was just beginning that change in culture from what they called chasing 911 to really trying to get outside of the cars and engage in what is true community policing, which is forming relationships in the community to establish trust. I mean, that's what it is all about, is trust, that if I do go to the police for help, they will help me, right?
Yeah.
And so, yes, and it was, you know, look, no organization operates, you know, everyone operates the same. So there were some officers who were more into it than others. But by and large, that culture was beginning to take hold and grew while I was there. And it really has manifested in many of the things that were going on was Pat was there and while I'm there, which is trying to engage the community. We've had several chiefs, quite a few chiefs, who've been very, very focused and conscientious about that.
Forte was remarkable in that regard, wasn't
Absolutely
he?
Absolutely remarkable.
And, you know,
mm-hmm.
Corwin was, too, because mm-hmm. yes. and I'm convinced
that's former Chief Jim Corwin you're talking
correct.
About. Yeah,
I should be a little bit more complete. It is part and parcel of policing in a major metropolitan area right now. And so I think anybody who you see, we're in the middle of a new chief search right now. Anybody who is going to be a contender has to have community credibility, has to have relationships, and has to have the ability to form street-level relationships with members of the community.
No question.
If our listeners want to join our good conversation here about how to stem the tide of violence in Kansas City, we're visiting with two former presidents of the Kansas City Board of Police Commissioners, Jeff Simon and Pat McInerney. Our number, 816-235-2888, or you can tweet us at KCUR up to date. You know, if Mayor James was sitting here at the table with us, he'd point quickly, I think, to one big issue, which is the proliferation of guns. There's too many of them, he says, and lawmakers in Jeff City refuse to do anything about it. To what extent is the proliferation of handguns the issue here?
Well, some
officers say maybe not so much.
It's a lot easier to kill somebody with a gun than anything else, Steve. Mm-hmm. 116 of 127 homicides in 2016 were handguns. So 11 didn't involve handguns, 116
wow.
did. So
yeah.
Anybody who says guns have nothing to do with it is wrong. That's just wrong, okay? Now, our culture, our society, our government has to make a decision. Where is the role of guns in our society? And the you know, there's going to be consequences to that in both directions. We have made a decision, the Second Amendment and interpretations in the current political environment, that we want guns to be liberally available. Well, there's going to be more guns you have, the more people are going to be shot. Now, mm-hmm. there's all kinds of policy debates and everything else, but guns are very important. And one more thing, I'll turn it over to Pat. My son did a semester in Havana, Cuba, a semester abroad a couple of years ago. And of course, we were concerned to hear about Cuba and is he safe and all that. He told us he felt more safe in Havana, Cuba than he did in Brookside because there are no guns. Mm-hmm. There are no guns in Cuba.
Mm-hmm.
He felt more safe. Okay. Now, that's a political question and everything else. But, yes, guns are front and center in the violence.
I think that's a fight right now that we've lost. And that's not an excuse for continuing to try. 2 years ago, you could take a gun off a 17-year-old in Missouri. Now you can't.
Mm-hmm.
Can't do it in St. Louis, can't do it here, regardless of what the city council says and whatever. So that leaves us to focus on smart policing. That leaves us to spend our time and our resources informing officers on the street about who's there, about what situations are likely to create violence, and going at it that way. Because what we know is that, you know, to use a bad analogy, we're handcuffed when mm-hmm. it comes to the gun situation right now.
You know, race relations have gone hand in hand with the whole issue of policing in so many different ways in the last few years in this country. I'm wondering how you managed that issue when you were on the board and to what extent you think that African-Americans in this community trust the Kansas City, Missouri Police Department.
Steve, that is the core of the issue with policing, is racism. And, you know, I believe that our legacy of race in this country is at the core of a lot of the issues we're mm-hmm. dealing with. And we need to recognize that. Your previous caller or person you interviewed said something about our messy history. We need to confront our messy history on race, okay, because it's very much alive and affecting things today. I had no idea when I joined the police board in 1996 about the level of how race affects policing because it wasn't part of my world. I didn't grow up in it, but it is front and center, and it drives most of the issues that police face on the street, no question.
Pat?
I had the good fortune to be a prosecutor when I was a brand-new lawyer. I spent time in the Jackson County Prosecutor's Office, and I will echo what Jeff's just said. That is that the victims of violence that a lot of us dealt with there, especially in minority communities, were as much hostages as if they were put in a cage and locked up, and they were trying to raise their kids, and they were trying to do what they do and go to work and play by the rules, and they were the real victims in that situation. Mm. And, you know, has race historically affected law enforcement and policing in this community and probably every other community? Absolutely it has. But I think that's broken down, and I think we make strides against that when we develop and encourage and build relationships in the community. There's a reason you didn't see Ferguson in Kansas City. There's a reason you didn't see Baltimore in Kansas City. And that's not to say that we don't have a lot of work ahead of us, but that's to say that we also, in the last 15, 20, 25 years, have pretty remarkable law enforcement and minority community relationships.
Hey, to what extent did you emphasize this when you were running the police board? Because, you know, when I first came to town back in the mid-'80s, I was a police reporter for the Kansas City Star. I'm here to tell you, I had great admiration for a lot of those people, but there was racism in that department, and maybe in a thick way in some instances. You know, how has that been dealt with over the years?
Well, I think that with anything like race, the way you deal with it is shine a light on it and confront it and acknowledge it. Okay, we have to acknowledge that this is real and without condemning those involved. You know, I mean, we all form our worldviews based on our experience. And getting back to your last question, Steve, I was at the Morning Star Youth and Family Center yesterday with Reverend John Modest Miles.
Yeah,
and the work
sure.
they're doing down there is incredible.
Incredible, yeah.
And there was a room full of 100, you know, the most beautiful young children you've ever seen singing beautiful songs. Well, their experience, one of them told me their experience with the police is the police came into my house and took my brother or took my dad or broke up a fight. It's always an unpleasant. It's always a traumatic. When they see a police uniform, it's traumatic for them. When my kids see a police uniform, they're handing out a baseball card, or you know, they're speaking at the PTA, or it's a very different experience that my kids will have with a police officer than a child who's born into a home where there's violence and those sorts of things.
And how's the department managing that disparity?
Well, they're doing the best they can. It's a street level thing, and it's really up to an individual officer to be aware of that. Now, look. On the other side of things, it's very hard to be a police officer. It's very hard to have to confront these situations. It's very hard because your personal safety is at risk, right? And so as much as you might want to try to break these barriers down, your first thing you got to do is enforce the law and enforce it in a way that you're going to be kept safe as well as those around you. So we ask a whole lot of our street officers, Steve.
Let's go to some phone calls here. Let's go to Fred from Kansas City North. Fred, you're on Up to Date with Pat McInerney and Jeff Simon. Good morning.
Good morning. As a businessman, I think the police do a great job dealing with the issue after the fact.
Right.
I don't think that we'll solve it until we get better education in the grade school, high school, and preparing kids for maybe to go to college. When they come into a business and they can't fill out an application properly, we can't use them because you have in today's society. You have to be able to read well. You have to be able to write and communicate well. And there's a lot of kids coming out and asking for jobs that don't have those skills.
Okay.
Well, I mean, I think you're, not to speak for Jeff, but I think you're probably preaching to the choir here. There is not a sole source of...
You could speak for me.
just this once.
Yeah.
There's not a sole source of violence, and there's not a sole source of the situation we find ourselves in. It has to be, any approach has to be comprehensive and has to involve education, has to involve prevention, and also has to involve enforcement.
But here's the frustration. I agree with everything Pat has said. We've been saying that in this country for 30, 40, 50, 60
years.
Count them,
that's
years.
Right. That's right.
And here we are in 2017, Steve,
still
saying the same
that
thing.
Yeah.
So when are we going to get real, right? When are we going to really do something?
Well, you're right. And, you know, it's been popular in the last few years to talk about violence as a public health issue.
Right.
If we mean what we say,
right.
then why isn't the Kansas City, Missouri Health Department in this conversation? Why aren't they talking about violence right here in Kansas City? And I'm not slamming the health department. I'm saying we got to reach out and involve them because that solution, any solution or any approach, has to involve a different way of looking at things. If this was a disease, if this was some sort of a virus, for heaven's sakes, the CDC would have an outpost here. We would be on this so fast. But because it's violence and because of some of the things that we've just talked about, the history of this city, we don't involve public health in this. And CDC CDC has already said, the Centers for Disease Control has already said repeatedly, this needs to be approached as a public health issue.
Well, there is that group in town, Cease Fire, that aims to do just what you're talking about, to sort of, they regard all violence as a disease, and they go out and try to nip it in the bud before it occurs, and that's based in the health department, so there's some stuff going on there.
There's some stuff going on. I'd like to see the health department much more out front. I'd like to see them holding hands with Gene Peters Baker, holding hands with the next police chief to talk about what we can do from a public health epidemic perspective.
Right. I agree 100%. These are the kind of very major shifts that need to occur at the instance of the demand of the people before we're really going to make progress, Steve.
The tough thing here is that this city is already devoting something like 76% of its general fund to public safety, which includes fire as well as police. You know, there's a need clearly for more. You begin to wonder, how far can a community go in terms of devoting resources to a problem that's
but
as intractable as this
one? I don't think it's throwing money. I don't think it's throwing dollar bills. I think to an extent it's committing some additional personnel, but it's got to be strategic. I mean, for example, the homicide division right now is staffed for 100 homicides a year in this city, right? We're on pace to hit 135, 140. They are absolutely face down. They are taxed. So when we talk about devoting more resources, devoting more personnel, it's those kinds of issues that have to be strategically in focus.
Yeah, yeah, that's right. That's right. Absolutely. And my answer to your question is, Steve, the way we've been doing it for so long is making it better. There's no question that all of these things the police department and all the social service agencies in the city is doing, it would be much worse without that. But we're not getting to the core.
Back to some calls here. Murad from Harrisonville. Nice to have you.
Thank you very much for having me on your show. First, I want to, and I don't know exactly who made the comment, but I want to focus on this. I want to commend the gentleman who spoke about it being not just their problem, but my problem too. I'm an African-American male. I'm a black man. I lived in a society my entire life, and the one thing I know is a problem is that I cannot make racism go away. That's something that has to come from people who lack my color.
That's right.
That's how it got that way. And no matter what I say or do, I still run into that every single day.
Yeah.
So it's not just, it's the idea. I saw a comedian the other day who boasted the idea that if I say that's a racist comment or that's racist behavior and someone says to me, how do you know that? How can you prove that? I know that I feel it. My entire life I've felt it. And it's not because I'm paranoid about the society I live in, because I've done things to help many people, and color doesn't matter to me. But that's what I'm faced with. The money is not getting there. Someone commented about education. It is very important. And that sense of violence that we keep seeing is being trapped in a situation where maybe one out of 1,000 makes it to be successful. The rest of us just have to take this bitter sense of living, because that's what it amounts to, a bitter sense of living. So you take that mentality and put that into the society as a whole. I want those beautiful things. I want the beautiful home, the beautiful car, all the accessories that go along with it. And then we're faced with the underside of society to live with. And people don't recognize that back in the early 20s, the Italian-Americans and Irish-Americans did the exact same thing because they were put down. They had one advantage, though.
I got lots of calls here. Murad, I appreciate your phone call very much. Yeah, great comments. Yeah.
Great comments. I just want to say, Steve, the core of the problem here also is we live in two different worlds, right? I don't know what happens east of Troost, and there's no communication. There's no dialogue between these two communities that live together, okay? And that's why we can look at the same instance. We can look at the same circumstance completely differently.
Yeah.
And if you're a black person, race has driven a lot of the decisions that have been made about black people in the last 300 years in this country, right? If you're a white person, you haven't been affected by it, so you don't see it. It's this lack of understanding of one another.
Let's go to Henry, who works in the 18th and Vine District. Henry, welcome to you.
Yeah, hi. I'm a lawyer, so I just put that out there right away. And I think we underestimate how afraid the African-American and Hispanic community is of the police. or someone talked about how 98% of the people are doing the right thing and they would cooperate with the police, they would call the police. But it literally is a 50-50 proposition when the police show up whether or not they're going to arrest you as the victim. I'm a lawyer and I have no criminal record, but I've been arrested in cuffs with the police at least 6 times. My wife, who happens to be Caucasian, standing right beside me, called the police, and when they showed up, they threw me on the ground. And so this is they don't police the same way in the city as they police anywhere else. I know where it comes from. The police are so jaded. They're so overworked. The last 10 African-Americans or Hispanics that they saw were committing a crime, and then the 11th one, the good guy, the 11th one, they treat them the same way.
And Henry, I appreciate that. What I'm wondering from our board here, how do you combat that? Jaded police officer who's getting tired of what he's
I've heard Henry's story. I'll bet Jeff did too. I've heard Henry's story when I was on the board 100 times. Yeah. And that's not to minimize it. That's just to say it's a giant problem. And that kind of initial perception is a problem. I will tell you that the Kansas City Police Department has in place training and education with regard to first impressions, with regard to de-escalation. But every time there's an experience like that, whether it's Henry, who's a lawyer in the Vine District, or whether it's anybody else, it erodes that trust and communication we're talking about, and that's all they take.
That's away. Right. These officers put up with a lot, and let's not get off message here. These street officers put up with a lot and do a very good job, but they can do the right thing 99 times.
Right.
And that one time out of 100 that they're having a bad day and the 3 encounters before them were bad and they step out of line like this, that's the one we hear about.
Before you go, there's one thing I wanted to ask you, too, about, and that's the Board of Police Commissioners itself. And this is a state-appointed board. You two are appointed to the board not by the mayor but by the governor. Kansas City stands today as the only city in the country that lacks local control of its police department. And I'm wondering now, as you look back on it, is this state-run board the best way to run a local city police department? Pat, you want to? Jeff? Yeah.
What? We have local control because everybody who sits on the Board of Police Commissioners is a Kansas City resident. They are diverse. They are geographically diverse.
But you report not to the local citizenry. You report to the governor.
I was on the board for 4 years. I never heard from Jay Nixon, and I never heard from anybody in his office. It was
that was my experience
autonomous.
As well with Mel Carnahan. I never heard from the governor's office. I did on one occasion, and it wasn't to interfere with the police. But, Steve, we're at the churches, we're at the schools, we're at the ball games with the people affected by this. We are also, the Board of Police Commissioners is also working with the city council because our budget requires negotiations with the city council, and during my time, we made a lot of strides in that. And I think this idea of the board not having to account to the city council is a vestige of a long time ago.
What would happen if it flipped? If there was local control, what's the downside? What's the upside?
If you look at St. Louis, if you look at the St. Louis experience, it's been a difficult one. I'm not going to trash the city. I'm not going to trash the decisions of the voters over there. It's been a very difficult transition. If you flipped it here, my concern would be that operational decisions and deployment decisions would be made with politics injected. I'd be worried about a certain city councilman saying, you know what, if this district gets this number of officers, I want the same for my people because my people are worth the same.
Mm-hmm.
Instead of making an operational and tactical decision, that politics would play a big part in that.
And that's the bottom line. That's exactly right. That's exactly the concern. Yeah.
Let me thank our two good guests here, and I'm sorry we couldn't get to all our phone calls here this morning. Jeff Simon, a lawyer at Hush Blackwell, Pat McInerney, a lawyer at Spencer Fain, two former presidents of the Kansas City Board of Police Commissioners. You all need to come back and talk again because lots of people still want to talk and lots of questions here. Appreciate it both.
Thank you, Steve.
Time for a break. When we come back, we're going to talk about that border wall and why it might be a good idea or maybe it's not. I'm Steve Kraske, and you're listening to Up to Date on 89.3 KCUR. And we are back. I'm Steve Kraske. Tomorrow on the show, how the design of jails and prisons affects their effectiveness. We'll also learn about a few African-American women who changed our world for the better and meet June Davis, one of the first freedom riders of the early 1960s. So let's build the wall. Build the wall, and our problem with illegal immigration and drugs will come to a screeching end, or at least be severely curtailed. That's what President Donald Trump says, but how realistic is that? And would the wall achieve what its proponents suggest? With us to talk about this is Alan Burson. He's the nation's one-time border czar, a position he held under both Presidents Obama and Clinton. Technically, one of his titles was former Assistant Secretary for International Affairs for the Department of Homeland Security. He spoke yesterday at the Dole Institute of Politics. Alan, thanks for taking some time. I appreciate it.
Not at all, Steve. Good morning.
Let's build the wall, Alan, and we'll solve our security and immigration problems. We'll solve the illegal narcotics problems. What do you say to that?
In looking at that issue, I think there are three questions. First, is it desirable? Second, is it necessary?
Mm-hmm.
Is it required to accomplish the ends that people who find it desirable think it will accomplish? And the third, is it doable? Is it realistically achievable? So with regard to the first, is it desirable?
Right.
I think I will leave that, because that tends to be an issue of ideology, one that's based on more opinion than facts. And while I have a view, it's less important than I think my perspective and experience with regard to the two other questions.
But given your experience, would you build it?
It would be determined by my view as to whether or not it would accomplish what I thought needed to be accomplished, and then whether or not it was doable. So to that extent, I'd say, will the wall stop illegal immigration? Will it stop the movement of drugs? Are there other ways to achieve that? And I would look to actually our history over the last generation, in mm-hmm. which the border, when I first became involved with the border in the early 1990s, more than a million people a year were entering the country illegally, mostly through Southern California and across the Rio Grande, Rio Bravo River, and El Paso and Juarez. If you look at the situation today, in part because of President Trump's policy statements and rhetoric, we're dealing with an issue that's 20% the size of what it was 20 years ago. So just under 380,000 people crossed illegally. And the fact is, they were not from Mexico. 85% of the people crossing now are not from our neighbor Mexico, but rather from Central America, Honduras, Guatemala, El Salvador.
And you said, Alan, that the 380,000 people now crossing, they're crossing illegally. That's the number?
That's the number that it's been reduced to. Now, those who think that, in fact, that is when I say crossing illegally, Steve, I mean trying to cross illegally.
Mm-hmm.
When we began 20 years ago, we had 3,000 Border Patrol agents in the United States. Today, we have 22,000, and 19,000 of them are on the southwest border. So this is not 380,000 people entering the country illegally. It's 380,000 who tried to enter, and for the most part were stopped by the Border Patrol.
So given these declining numbers, is the wall necessary to go back to your second question?
So would it lead to the remaining number of people who are entering the country illegally, which are estimated to be under 100,000 now, compared to 1.6 million in the year 2000. And the answer to that, Steve, I think, is that it is not going to stop the remaining people who are entering illegally, because, in fact, you cannot seal the 1,900 miles on our southwest border. This cannot be closed off in places in the Rio Grande Valley with the Rio Grande River. You cannot do it in the Sonoran Desert or mm-hmm. in the Big Bend in Texas. We have 700 miles of barriers that have been constructed on the southwest border, and they have functioned very effectively with the additional equipment that has been placed there. Since the H.W. Bush administration, starting with the Clinton administration, then into the George W. Bush administration, continued into the Obama administration, now also in the administration of President Trump, we've spent $18 billion a year. So we not only have increased the size of the Border Patrol by a factor of seven, but we've placed equipment there, surveillance equipment, fences and walls around urban areas to keep the traffic moving to where the Border Patrol can apprehend it.
And we are seeing results, you're saying.
Absolutely. Absolutely. If you look at the number of people who are trying to cross and the number of people who are actually crossing illegally, they are a fraction of what they were 20 years ago, even 12 or 15 years ago. So from the standpoint of is it required, I think the answer on balance is no, that there are other ways of continuing to control the southwest border. So, for example, Steve, most unlawful drugs coming into the United States actually are not coming between the ports of entry. That is, they're not coming in the areas out in the rural areas or in the desert areas where the Border Patrol is actually effectively patrolled there for quite some time. Most of the illegal drugs coming into the United States are actually passing through the ports of entry. Huh. So that if we built a wall, it would not stop that flow. And remember the Janet Napolitano's sage observation that if you build a 50-foot wall, you will be confronted yes. by a criminal coming up with a 52-foot fence.
Yes.
we also have the issue of tunnels under the wall and around the wall on the maritime side of things, both in the Gulf of Mexico and in the Pacific Ocean on the coast of California.
You know,
look at the third question, though, which I think is also maybe dispositive of this debate, which is it doable? And I think it's no accident that in the appropriation process that's now ongoing, mm-hmm. you haven't found a single senator or a single member of Congress, for that matter, in any of the four border states, Texas, New Mexico, Arizona, or California, who actually have voted to appropriate the funds. Because by any measure of cost effectiveness, Steve, this is not an effective way to deal with the remaining problems that we have on the border.
That's interesting. Our guest again, Alan Burson. He's a former drug czar or a border czar for the U.S. government, a position he held under both presidents, Clinton and Obama. You know, the president continues to say, Alan, that Mexico will not only build the wall but pay for it too. What impact has that had on relations between the two countries and trying to deal with problems like illegal drugs that both countries are so heavily invested in?
Well, I think to some extent by now the Mexican political leaders have recognized that this is a rhetorical flourish that not many people around the president, if in fact he himself believes that Mexico will pay for the wall. They're certainly not going to pay for it, and if President Peña Nieto has declared that they will not pay for it. And then the threat that, well, they will pay for it through a border tax actually has been also rejected by American communities. I think the president has given us an opportunity to look at NAFTA again, mm-hmm. and that has been seized, and now we're not going to scrap NAFTA as was originally planned, but rather renegotiate it, and we are preparing to do that. And that is a good thing. That will give us a chance to update a 25-year treaty that actually needs to be updated to take into account digital developments, intellectual property developments, and to deal with problems that have been become obvious over the last 25 years. But in fact, this idea of putting a border tax on is something that will not be supported. And I found it interesting, in spending the last couple of days in Kansas here in Lawrence at the university, that in fact Kansas farmers understand that all of their corn crop and a fair amount of the wheat that's grown in this part of the country actually is sold to Mexico, and Mexico is the best customer for 29 of the 50 American states. So we are beginning to recognize, I think, more generally than those of us who live on the border have recognized for a long time, that we are linked with Mexico and with Canada, but we're linked with Mexico in a shared production platform and an economy that now is interdependent. So among the three countries, we have $1.2 trillion in trade a year, just under $700 billion a year in bilateral trade with Mexico. This is not a relationship that ripping apart would actually serve either the United States or Mexico. And I think actually to the credit of the Trump administration, the people who were charged with reviewing this matter grasp that very well.
You know, I want to go back to the whole illegal drug thing, because you once said that what's going on in Mexico across the border in Juarez requires that we support the government of Mexico in its very valiant, courageous effort to both stem violence and also deal with the drug trafficking organizations. And I'm wondering, do we need to do more to help Mexico in its ongoing war against these illegal drug traffickers?
Absolutely, and we can do that in two ways. First and foremost, we need to deal with the drug demand issue in this country. We need to recognize that 60,000 Americans died in the most recent context from opiate addiction and overdose, and a large part of this comes from heroin that is being grown and transported from Mexico into the United States. Wreaking havoc on our communities. So we need to do two things. We need to actually face up to the fact that we consume drugs at a rate that is higher per capita than any or in gross totals than has ever been the case ever before. And we need to get serious about drug demand reduction in this country and recognize that it's a health problem of massive proportions that will take an enormous effort on the part of all American communities and governments at every level to deal with. And then we need to double down with what has been the kind of cooperation with Mexico that was unthinkable 10 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
Ever since the administration of George W. Bush with the Merida Agreement, we have had an increased and enhanced during the Obama administration, we have developed a relationship with Mexico that recognizes that not only are our economies interdependent, but our security situations are interdependent, that in fact, the flow of drugs, rather than pointing fingers at one another, we need to address it as a single problem that has a demand issue on our side and a supply issue on their side. And we've seen cooperation with Mexico in terms of law enforcement that has produced satisfactory results, but we need to double down on that. I believe we'll find cooperation. I believe Secretary Kelly, who was in Homeland Security Secretary John Kelly, who was in Mexico with their security minister, Osorio Chong, I think they have continued the kind of cooperation that has really been improved over the last 10 to 20 years, and we need to double down on that, as I say, and we'll see even more satisfactory results downstream.
Yeah, I've got just about 30 seconds left, Alan. You're known for taking jobs for which you have very little experience at times. What were some of the first things you learned as border czar back in the 90s that you hadn't known before?
That most of what happens at the border is generated by effects or causes far from the border. I was listening to your previous segment on police violence issues, and the same thing is true there. These issues end up with the police department. They end up with the Border Patrol, but in fact, they're generated by causes and effects far from the border, far from the street where the police interact. So we need to look at those causes and effects in a much more holistic way than simply thinking if we put a big wall of China on our border that the problems that that we have are going to disappear. They're going to isolate us rather than strengthen us.
That's Alan Burson, again, the nation's one-time border czar. He spoke yesterday at the Dole Institute of Politics. And Alan, thank you very much for the time. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
Bill Brownlee is back with this week's Local Listen to talk about a group in town doing some great stuff. And Bill, always good to have you here.
So glad to be here, Steve.
Let's talk about Mike Dillon and Blast Beat Samba. That's his new track from his new album. Yeah.
Things are about to get very strange around here, Steve. This is some avant-garde jazz metal we're about to hear.
Wow.
From a guy named Mike Dillon, who currently resides in New Orleans, but he's always on the road. He spent years here in Kansas City working in Kansas City's outsider music scene, and he's coming back to town as he does a couple times a year. He'll be at the Brick on Friday night.
I haven't heard this track. Do folks need to hang on to their hats here?
Everyone needs to brace themselves and realize that this won't last forever.
Okay. This is Blast Beat Samba from Mike Dillon's new album, Life is Not a Football. That's Mike Dillon, and that's a load, Bill.
Yeah, there's a lot going on there.
A lot going on there.
You know, it's because of my age, I've always been obsessed with both jazz and heavy metal, and it's really hard to make the two things come together effectively, and Mike Dillon is doing it about as well as it can be done here with this track.
There's a lot of anger in this track.
There's a lot of anger in Mike Dillon's music.
Okay.
But, you know, this it comes from a release called Life is Not a Football. It's his third album in 12 months.
Wow.
This new release is, most of it sounds like this, but one of his three new albums is a straight-ahead jazz album. As you can hear, he's playing vibraphone and marimbas on this track. So he can do the Bobby Hutcherson thing as well as the Iron Maiden thing.
Wow, that's amazing. You know, he's mainly a percussionist, and the marimba definitely stands out, but where the heck does the heavy metal part come from? Any feel for that?
Well, Mike Dillon is in the tradition of Frank Zappa in that he incorporates elements from popular music and the classical realm into his brand of jazz. And as noisy as this is, his shows are avant-garde dance parties.
Really?
No one's going to be standing still at the Brick on Friday. Everyone's going to be moving.
I was going to say, what kind of following does he have here in town?
Friday's show will be a reunion of every musical weirdo in town, whether they play an instrument or not.
Yeah.
There's an underground community of people who appreciate and admire this kind of music.
Again, that's Mike Dillon. He performs at the Brick on Friday. This week, coming up on Friday, Mike Dillon will be playing tracks from his new album, Life is Not a Football. He's something. Thanks, Bill.
Thanks, Steve.
Appreciate it. You can follow us on Twitter. We're at KCUR Up to Date, and you can follow me at Steve Kraske. Tomorrow, why the design of a jail matters for its success. And yes, we're referring to the Jackson County Jail. And we'll learn about a few African-American women who changed our world for the better. Danny Alexander, Luke Martin, Coy Duggar, and Marlia Campbell produce our show. I'm Steve Kraske, and you are up to date.